a one.
Quiet, please,
ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You are
in exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
And then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Is he a danger to society? Yes. Is he a danger to women's health? Yes. Is he a danger to world peace? Yes. But don't give him more credit than he needs. He's just a strange, weird dude.
That's right. That's Tim Walz, governor of Minnesota. And we got to say a few things about him. If he thinks that Donald Trump is a strange, weird dude, wait till you hear the background of Tim Walz, the pick of Kamala Harris as the vice presidential running mate of the Democrats. Candidate for president chosen without any voters being involved at all. I mean, because we need to remind you that when she ran in 2020, she didn't get a single vote from a single American because she dropped out before the primaries. And then Joe Biden ran in the primaries and Kamala Harris did not, and he got the votes and she got none. And now the Democrat Party has anointed her as its candidate, despite the fact they have yet to hold their national convention, whose very purpose is supposed to be to pick a presidential nominee. And she's already picked her vice presidential nominee. And no, she's not going to let the delegates have a hand in that at all. She has chosen Tim Walz, governor of Minnesota. And he appeared on this program called White Dudes for Harris, where they raised about $3 million for Kamala Harris. I'll tell you what, Walz is a communist. I mean, this is a guy who Bernie Sanders absolutely loves, and I've got some of his comments about that. You got to talk about his background as the guy who was a lockdown governor of a state during the pandemic. He was a do-nothing governor during the riots that began in Minnesota and then spread to the rest of the countryside. Antifa and BLM wreaking literally billions of dollars of damage, 36 murders and all of that. What was Tim Walz doing in Minnesota? He was doing a whole lot of nothing. And then, of course, he had the same kind of policy about sending people sick with COVID who were from nursing homes right back to the nursing homes. If you thought that Andrew Cuomo was bad in New York State, Tim Walz made him pale by comparison. And during the pandemic, he locked kids out of school for more than half of the 2021 school year and then lied about it. We'll get to that in a moment at the first. But first of all, he sees this as a great opportunity to actually send a message to President Donald Trump.
How often in 100 days do you get to do something that's going to impact generations to come? And how often in the world do you make that bastard wake up afterwards and know that a black woman kicked his ass and sent him on the road?
Yeah, that's Governor Tim Walz. He's a piece of work, to be sure. He pushed to raise Minnesota's gas taxes by 70%. He supported the idea of turning Minnesota into a sanctuary, not just for illegal aliens, but for doctors who do chemical mutilation of transgender kids. He opposed the border wall. And he shut the state down and put the kids in masks during the pandemic. He even established what's known as a snitch line for citizens to rat out their neighbors if they were violating orders of the state during the pandemic. And he's completely in favor of gender transition for kids. So you're not going to be surprised. San Francisco liberal Kamala Harris surprised nobody with this morning's choice of another radical left winger from Minnesota, Governor Tim Walz, as her running mate. Kamala kept the pro-Hamas terrorism, death to America end of the Democrat Party happy by not picking the Jewish Pennsylvania governor, Josh Shapiro. Maybe that's going to cut down on riots at election time. If so, that's a good thing. But Walz is a real piece of work. Listen to what he has to say about socialism.
Don't ever shy away from our progressive values. One person's socialism is another person's neighborliness. Just do the damn work.
One person's socialism is another person's neighborliness. I consider neighborliness that if one of my neighbors says, Lars, I need some help, I will be glad to give them my help. But it's my decision. When the government comes at the point of a gun and says, we're taking your money, we're taking your things, we're taking your property, and we're going to give it to somebody else because they deserve it more than you do, that is not neighborliness. That is theft. And when it comes to socialism and redistribution of wealth, it doesn't surprise me at all that Kamala Harris identifies with somebody like Tim Walz. And speaking of neighbors, Walz held a signing ceremony with a huge crowd where he signed a law in Minnesota granting driver's licenses, government picture ID to illegal aliens. He was proud of that. And if you listen to Walz, illegals, according to him, deserve health insurance and college tuition funded by the taxes of American citizens. Abortion on demand up to the moment of birth. Of course, Tim Walz is in favor of that. Walz favors putting the oil companies out of business, just like Kamala Harris has said she plans to do. And as for giving parents any kind of choice, well, you should already know, for Democrats, choice is about killing babies. When it comes to education, you get no choice. Walz just dismisses that great idea.
These are the guys that take money out of our public schools to for private schools to give vouchers to people already going to private school. They undermine the basic social safety net that makes this country great.
Yeah, hold on a second. The social safety net. In other words, when you shove kids into schools that fail, that are run by the government, that is better than giving parents a choice about taking those resources anywhere they want to go, bringing competition to education. And by the way, Walz is the longtime governor of Minnesota. He has schools in his state that are now at a 30-year low in terms of student achievement. And yet Walz lies about it. Walz actually said, 80% of our kids during the pandemic missed less than 10 days of in-class learning. Technically, that may be true. What he doesn't tell you is that Minnesota kids were only in school that year 47% of the time. But out of the 47%, they were in the school less than half the year. They only missed 10 days or less of in-class learning. He even disparages citizens of his own state, calling rural areas mostly cows and rocks. That's his attitude toward rural people in his own state. Now, Walz did serve in the National Guard. You're going to hear he did military service. But in his campaign for Congress back then, he falsely claimed the rank of Command Sergeant Major and then quit his National Guard unit in the middle of his reenlistment. He had reenlisted in 2001 after the attack on America. And when the orders came to deploy to Iraq, he quit, and his National Guard colleagues didn't think much of that. Take a listen to what Walz thinks of his National Guard today.
I think the mayor said I request the National Guard. Whew, I'm out. This is great. We're going to have massively trained troops. No, you're going to have 19-year-olds who are cooks in some cases. And what are we going to do and how are we going to use them?
How are we going to use them? Boy, he doesn't seem to think much of the National Guard, where he once served falsely as a command sergeant major. Actually, he made it all the way to staff sergeant. Has Walz lied about his military record? He has claimed he signed up for four more years after 9/11, but he actually signed up for six more years, and then he quit just before his unit was deployed to Iraq, and some of his fellow service members in the National Guard accused him of deserting them. Well, all in all, he sounds like the perfect representative of America's not-so-Democrat party. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Naysayers, as always, go to the head of the line on the Lars Larson Show. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our X poll today, should more states follow Louisiana's lead and make it the law that you castrate child predators? I'm going to give that one a yes. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Coming up on the Radio Northwest Network, what happens when Washington State's Secretary of State wants Elon Musk's help to control information going to citizen voters? That's next.
Informed and always guessing what he'll say next. Here's Lars Larson.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead, fish wrapper, or mainstream media bias.
Washington State's Democrat Secretary of State Steve Hobbs wants Elon Musk's help to control the information the that voters like you and me see and hear. The bizarre request joins officials from four other states, not surprisingly, all liberal states, who want the owner of the social media platform X, formerly known as Twitter, to reprogram its AI search assistant. Hobbs and his company accuse the AI, known as Grok, of generating false information about ballot deadlines. Quote, if the owner of a social media platform themselves is not going to share misleading information or is going to share misleading information, it signals to the rest of us that other materials allowed there may not be trustworthy. You know, I apply that same rule to the FBI and the CIA as well. Hobbs wants X to send people to the website run by the overwhelmingly Democrat-dominated bureaucracy of the state of Washington. Now, does that sound like a good idea to you? Because it doesn't to me. Frankly, I'd prefer the deep staters like Hobbs stick to their own business. Run the elections where you only count the legal votes cast by citizens, not illegals, and clear the voter rolls of non-citizens, dead people, and people who live and vote in other states. Our question of the day, and this one comes in from Ambassador James Gilmore. Tim Walz says socialism is just neighborliness. That statement is genial, folksy, and profoundly ignorant. Who would pick somebody like that? The answer is cackling Kamala Harris. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
I'm going to give the Daily Grill to the folks in charge in the state of Oregon in this case, although Washington's almost as bad. 1.2 million acres have burned in Oregon. That is four times more than the average number of acres burned in an average year. And I pointed out to you before, Oregon and Washington had about a third of a century when we had no major fires at all. None of them. For 35 years, from 1952 to 1987. And what is the difference? Well, active management of the forests and wildlands during that time, ending the logging in about the late 80s, and then we have had catastrophic fires ever since. So when you hear the folks in Salem or Olympia complain about how many acres are lost to fire, understand it's a conscious choice by the folks in charge. They have chosen to let your forest burn. And when I say your forest, I'll remind you, you own them. I own them. The public owns them. They are badly managed by people in public office. Today's best email of the day, but you can send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Forest Cat in Sudden Valley, Bingham, he says, city of subdued reality, means Bellingham. Hey, Lars. Kamala is so phony. What a condescending climber. When she was first elected to the Senate, she posed with her family in Indian garb and was widely touted in the mainstream media as the first Indian American senator. Now that Kamala needs black votes, she goes to black events and changes her dialect to act in the hood and on the street. What a phony. Okay, if fifth graders on the left think they're so clever by calling us weird, well, at least we're real patriotic America first values, not malleable like phony Kamala. Signed, Forest Cat, pronoun meow. Let's go to our first naysayer of the day, and that is Eli. Eli, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network and KMED. What's on your mind, and what do you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer?
Oh, well, I heard you say that Kamala Harris picked her vice president running mate without any input from the voters. And I'm wondering if you have a problem with the way that Trump picked his vice president running mate.
Not at all, because Donald Trump was chosen by the voters as the nominee of the Republican Party. Did the voters of it? Hold on. Let me finish. I let you finish. Did the Democrats allow Democrat voters in America to choose their presidential nominee?
That's not what I'm talking about.
Well, it is what I'm talking about because, Eli, I consider her fruit of the poisonous tree. She was chosen without voters, so are her choices valid when she makes choices for the voters and she wasn't chosen by the voters? Donald Trump was chosen by the voters, correct?
That's not what you said.
Is that correct?
Yeah, but that's not what you said.
She chose her vice president without any input from the voters. When the voters choose a presidential candidate, they give that candidate license to pick his or her running mate. In the case of Donald Trump, the voters chose Donald Trump. On the Republican side, he chose his running mate. Did the voters choose Kamala Harris?
Well, they voted for her when
did they vote for
vice
her?
President.
When did they vote
for
her?
They voted for her when she ran for vice president.
No, they didn't. They voted for Joe Biden.
She was on the ticket.
She was on the ticket as an also ran as the substitute goods, the placeholder, just in case something bad happened to Joe.
Yeah,
and unfortunately, bad things have happened to Joe, but he's not gone.
I just wish you'd be more straightforward with this.
I'm asking you, do you think that Kamala Harris, not chosen as the Democrat nominee, even though 14 million people voted for Joe Biden and nobody voted for Kamala, is she the legitimate choice to represent the Democrat Party?
Well, no, that's not what I'm calling about.
Well, I know what you're calling about. We've already dealt with that. Do you want to go back over it three or four more times?
Oh.
Because everybody's heard your point that we don't elect vice presidents anymore. America used to. I'm not asking to go back to that system if that's what you're asking. We used to have a system where presidents and vice presidents ran separately. We don't have that system anymore.
Forward in the way you talk about stuff.
Do you think anybody listening to this does not know exactly what I'm talking about? America has not voted for vice president separately in more than 100 years. So why would anybody be confused except you?
That's not what I was saying. You keep changing what I'm saying.
What were you saying?
I'm not saying that.
What were you saying?
I'm saying you said that Harris chose her running mate without any input from the voters.
That is correct.
That's exactly.
And I'll stand by that. Eli, I'll stand by that because like I tried to explain to you, I'll try to keep it to one syllable words.
No, you don't need to repeat.
When a presidential candidate is chosen by a party, that gives him the authority from the voters to then choose his running mate, his cabinet, his secretary of state, and everybody else he makes the choice of. Kamala Harris was not chosen by that. She doesn't have a single vote from 2020. She doesn't have a single vote from 2024. So when she chooses anything, what color suit to wear today, she's not doing it because the voters chose her. So that makes her choices. And I think what you're doing is you're avoiding the subject of is Tim Walz, would he make a good vice president for the United States given his ugly history?
No, I'm not. That's not even what I'm calling.
But I'm asking you a question. You've already made your point, Eli. Everybody's heard it three or four times. Would Tim Walz make a good vice president?
No.
Okay. That's all I wanted to know from you. Because this guy is if you think Kamala Harris is a crazy left-wing liberal, Tim Walz looks like 10 times the crazy liberal that she is. He says socialism is just a form of neighborliness. I think he's going to rue the day he said that out loud, but he's the guy who said it, and he's taken ugly positions on just about every major issue. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. If we keep meeting like this, people are going to talk. Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Tuesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my pleasure to be with you, and we're glad to get to your phone calls and emails. You can join the best conversation in talk journalism right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. If you're a naysayer, you get right to the head of the line if you disagree with me or something said by one of my guests. And Noah Ernst joins me now. I want to tell you something, Noah. I have to applaud your willingness to come on this program. There are 12 Portland City Council seats because Portland is changing its form of government. There are dozens of candidates running and only one who's agreed to come on the show and actually answer questions. So good on you.
Oh, well, I'm happy to be here. I really feel like I will show up and talk to anybody about anything. And if you disagree with me, well, you learn more from talking to people who disagree with you than you learn from talking to people who think exactly the same way you do. So from my point of view, I don't see how I lose.
I couldn't agree with you more. Now, let me ask you this, because I want you to be able to tell my audience where to find out more about you as a candidate. So your social media in a moment. But I want to know this. From a distance, I thought this was one of the dumbest things that Portland's ever done. And believe me, Portland and Seattle have both done dumb things. But to say we have a tough time representing the people and making good decisions with five city council members, so we're going to more than double the number of the city council members and think we're going to get better decisions or better representation. Do you believe this is going to work?
Well, I wouldn't be running if I didn't think we could make it work. It isn't necessarily, I think, the perfect solution, but I think the fact that when presented with an option, people overwhelmingly voted to change the structure of city government in Portland lets you know how frustrated they were with the current form of government. And
very
so,
true.
You know, is it the perfect solution? I don't know if it is the perfect solution. I know it's the solution that we got. I know that I'm committed to making it work. And the representation improvement, and one of the reasons I'm excited to run, comes from the fact that they've finally divided the city into districts. And so for the first time, we're going to get people on the city council who are actually from and understand the different districts. And thankfully, we'll finally get somebody on city council who represents East Portland.
Yeah, not a bad idea in concept, and I don't agree with that. I don't disagree with that part of it. But Noah, I'll give you a chance. Tell my audience where to find you on social media, because they can read more extensively about where you're coming from. But you call increasing crime one of the biggest issues you're tackling. I want to know what you would change if you were on the city council, one vote of 12. How you would make changes that would make the situation better. I've got my own ideas. My audience has heard them. I want to hear your ideas.
Okay. Well, you can find me at Noah Ernst. That's NOAHERNST, the number 4, Portland.com. And I'm Noah Ernst, the number 4, Portland on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter/X. So that's where you can find me. You can email me at info@NoahErnstForPortland.com if you have questions and that sort of thing. I understand what you're saying. One vote of 12 isn't a lot.
No, that's okay. It's one vote of 12, but how would you change things to bring down what has been a pernicious problem? Gigantic increases in crime, and especially violent crime and crimes related to drugs. What would you do to change it?
The number one thing we have to do is hire more police officers.
What happened to Noah? Let's put him back on hold for a second. Joel, will you make sure we can get him back? Because I don't know what happened with that connection, but it went away. So, yep, we're going to have to grab him back. But, right there, you've got a major change from what has been going on up till now. You got a mayor right now sitting in office who doesn't believe in hiring more cops. He voted to defund the cops. Now and finally, we have somebody who's suggesting that maybe we should hire more cops. And I think he was about to say, and I think I'm guessing right here, before the pandemic, Portland and Seattle were notoriously under-policed. And then during the pandemic, the numbers went down even more. Noah, I was just telling my audience, sorry about the dropped connection. I don't know where it happened. But what would you do? You want to hire more cops, and then what?
I want to hire more officers. I want to empower them to do their jobs. You have to be able to, when they get there, respond appropriately to the situation that arises. I'm frustrated, like a lot of people are, about if you mention that the person committing the crime is homeless, suddenly you don't get the police, you get social services, when this is the underlying behavior is criminal behavior, it's not social behavior. I work with police officers fairly often as a superintendent at Radio Cab. We help, you know, pull video of cameras, we help them track people. Obviously, we recently had a driver killed, and the one thing I heard that really shocked me is that officers are being told that before they intervene in a situation, they have to be able to articulate a state interest. And my response was, the state interest was articulated by the legislature that passed the law.
Agreed.
The officer's job is to go there and enforce the law, to protect people, right? It's not for them to substitute their judgment for the legislature that passed the law and the governor that signed it. And we need to take those barriers out of the way.
I couldn't agree with you more. What else would you do to change the way the city runs? Because the city spends an amazing amount of money, about $7 billion, and they spend less than 10% of that on all of public safety. Would you change that?
Oh, I believe that we need to spend the resources that will put enough police on the street so that we resolve the crime issues. I've been asked specifically, is it 400 more officers or is it 800 more officers? And my answer is 400 more officers gets us to what an average is for a city our size per capita. But the reality is, if that it doesn't make it so that our police can respond effectively and efficiently, then we need more officers than that, at least until we get on top of the crime that's going on in the city.
I'm talking to Noah Ernst, who's running for the Portland City Council. Let me ask you one that's come up recently. We've got police officers who try to do their job. They go to arrest somebody who is homeless. The person who's homeless has been offered other places to stay, refuses, stays camped out on public property. And then the county sheriff says, I will not lock them up. And we also have prosecutors who say, I will not prosecute them. What does the city do when the other players in the system refuse to work on it?
Well, we have a new prosecutor, so hopefully that will change, and the attitude towards crime from that prosecutor will change. The other thing we can do is what the, you issue citations, you go through that process. I don't think that's as effective. I think we have to work with everybody to try to build a consensus around how to best manage this. We have to change the law that is in Salem that currently restricts our ability to move homeless people off the streets.
Agreed.
The ultimate goal here is not to, I don't think anybody thinks the best solution is to lock up homeless people. But what we have done is created a system where it's all carrot and no stick. There's no consequence for not getting treatment or not getting off the street or those sorts of things. And I think it has to be both. We have to incentivize people to get the help that they need, the help that's available, and turn their lives around.
And if they choose not to, then they get the stick. Okay, Noah, tell people again where they can find you online. You're the only one of the city council members or candidates willing to come on. Where can they find you quickly?
Noah Ernst, NOAHERNST, the number 4, Portland.com.
Very good. Noah Ernst for Portland.com. Back in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. And believe me, we try to talk to Seattle City Council members, too. We don't get too many takers, but that's because we ask hard questions. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Being a landlord.
Best investment in talk radio, and it's free. Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Tuesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and our endeavor every single day is to try to serve the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, the Pacific Northwest, with honestly provocative talk. And you can reach in and join the conversation, too, at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. I want to update you on something that just broke within the last hour, and it's on the national level, not the local level here in the Northwest. But I told you about the time, about July 13th, when the attempted assassination of President Trump happened, that the U.S. government, we found out fairly quickly, was already on notice that there had been a plot to try to assassinate President Trump, that plot was being backed up by the Iranian government. And, of course, the Iranian government is backed up by Joe Biden, who unfroze literally tens of billions of dollars in assets that put money back in the pockets of the mad mullahs of Tehran. He also indicated to Iran that he would stop enforcing sanctions against them selling oil. That put literally tens of billions of dollars in the pockets of Iran. Iran being the biggest sponsor of terrorism on the globe as a state, they began sponsoring terrorism again. They had extra cash. The news that broke within the last couple of hours, the U.S. Justice Department has charged Asif Merchant, a 46-year-old man from Pakistan with ties to the Iranian government, with a plot to carry out political assassinations. The arrest on July 12th, the day before the attempted assassination of President Trump, resulted in what they called enhanced security for former President Trump and U.S. government officials. Well, if what we saw in Pennsylvania on July 13th was enhanced security, then that means the regular security wasn't very much to write home about. A Justice Department official has confirmed that the case involving Merchant was the threat the Secret Service was aware of when it began to ramp up Trump's security in the lead up to the Butler, PA rally where he was shot. Federal prosecutors filed the charges in Brooklyn against Asif Merchant, who reportedly traveled to New York City, collaborated with hitmen on that plot, according to our friend John Solomon, the great investigative reporter. I also have the DOJ statement that came out today. They indicate that Merchant was trying to leave the United States at the time he was taken into federal custody. He is now under arrest. He is indicted. He was allegedly plotting with Iranian backing, again, paid for by Joe Biden, to assassinate Donald Trump. Can you think of a better conspiracy theory than that? And it's not even Conspiracy Theory Thursday yet. Glad to have you with me. And if you want to vote in our X poll, we put up a brand new question representing the news of the day. As of Thursday, last Thursday, August the 1st, the state of Louisiana became the first state in America in which child rapists can now be ordered by a judge to be castrated if the victim was under the age of 13 and if the offender is older than 17 years of age. The law also allows judges to issue an order of chemical castration. The law also includes the crime of pornography involving juveniles as an underlying offense. And just so it's not limited to male offenders, it goes to female offenders as well. Should more states follow Louisiana's lead and castrate child predators? I'd give a hearty yes to that. You can vote any way you like. You'll find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. It's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Yesterday's poll question, has Joe Biden wrecked the American economy? I would say yes, and Donald Trump warned us he would. 95% of you agreed and voted yes as well. Only 5% of you were naysayers. On that note, let's go to Ed in Winlock, Washington, listening on the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, Ed, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, good afternoon, Lars. First, thank you for taking my call, and thank you for what you do.
Sure.
I'm kind of wondering if the fix is kind of in even for this primary election for our state. When I received my ballot, I got my pamphlet. There's nothing in there for the Fed or the state. The only thing in there is for the local.
Well, or for statewide races. Really, I mean, I got my ballot as well. I've marked my ballot. I'll be delivering it by hand tonight before the deadline. And it included state superintendent of public instruction, secretary of state, a number of judge races, and that sort of thing, because the other choices have already been made. What are you seeing is missing?
Well, trying to pick like the superintendent of public instruction, insurance.
That's a state office.
The governor and the lieutenant governor. You know, I'm trying to make sure that my vote counts, but there's so many hidden rhinos and Republicrats being, you know, bought by the Democrats you don't know who to vote for. There's so many on here. I know it's just a primary.
Well, it's what they call a jungle primary. They no longer do it by party. I wish, because I vote in Washington State, I wish that they would go back to a Republican primary and a Democrat primary and have us choose the candidates we choose in a primary. It would also have to come considerably earlier in a presidential election year, but they like the jungle primary. I mean, in theory, the jungle primary could actually produce a Democrat running against another Democrat for offices in November. Now, what kind of choice is that? One Democrat versus another, or two Republicans could happen as well. It's a dumb system, but that is the system until we change it. And yes, I'd like to see a change as well. Glad to be with you on a Tuesday. Glad you're listening on the Radio Northwest Network. If you want to jump in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And this is the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and emails. You know, we had a major piece of economic news yesterday in the United States. Japan had seen a massive hit to its stock market. It lost 12.5% of its value. America, not nearly so bad, but still more than 1,200 points on Wall Street in a single day. And if you say, well, what does that mean to me? Well, a lot of these developments have shockwaves that are going to go into places like home mortgages and the rest of the economy. So I thought I'd call our friend Nick Shivers, who's one of the many great supporters of this program. He's got a real estate business called the Nick Shivers Team. Nick, welcome back. And can you put this in perspective in ways that will make it relevant to the people who don't own a lot of stocks, don't trade on the marketplace, but do care about whether or not they might someday own a home or someday be able to sell the home they're in now and buy a better one?
Sure, Lars. And it's kind of that catch-22, because traditionally when the economy is not doing well, interest rates, because the Fed's always a day late and a dollar short, right? They cut rates too late, and they raise rates too late, and that's kind of what we're seeing right now. So it's always that catch-22. You hate to see unemployment go up. You don't like to see the stock market necessarily drop, because that's affecting pensions and so forth and so on. But what we have seen is, in about the span of about a two-week time frame, we saw rates yesterday as low as on a 30-year conventional down to 6.3, and for like an FHA VA, it got below 6 yesterday. Now, the stock market, both the Japan stock market and the U.S. stock market bumped up pretty considerably today. So rates are back up to 6.5 on conventional loans and 6% on government-backed FHA and VA loans.
Now, is it fair to say that that's still prohibitive for the vast majority of people in America? Because, you know, I'll remind people, the day Joe Biden took the oath of office in January 3 years ago, the lowest rate on a 30-year mortgage was 2.65. And now it's well over double that. It's not quite triple, but it's well over double that. And it locks a lot of people out of buying or even selling, doesn't it?
Right, because if you factor in the inflation that we've seen since Biden got in, I mean, home values, even though, remember, real estate's hyper-local, but even though some areas have seen a little bit of a price correction, it's very small, 1%, 2%, and we had a 20 to 25% run-up. So, yes, even that's why it's not going to move the needle that we've seen a 1% drop. It's not going to, like, just take the market crazy again, because again, it's still historic home values compared historically, and interest rates are still considerably high over the last 3 to 4 years.
And they're not just high for the people who want to buy, the individual who wants to buy a house. They're high for all the companies that might want to go out and build more housing because of all that gigantic need that's built up out there. I mean, we have a shortage of housing. You've talked about that every time you've been on. And you say, well, why don't the builders build more? And you say, well, because they have to borrow money that's much more expensive, in many cases pay labor and materials costs that are much more expensive. And then they're trying to sell a house into a marketplace where maybe half of their potential buyers aren't there because the interest rates are too high for them to afford them. So why would somebody spend a lot of money to build a house at extraordinary costs and then try to sell it into a marketplace with fewer buyers?
Yeah, that's what happens when you have only academia on the Fed. Because, Lars, one of the things that we're already seeing, okay, 2008, 2009, it shut off new construction. And that was because of the crisis. Right now, what we're seeing is almost the same levels of new construction starts stop. Everything that's been built is starting. But everybody stopped because of interest rate. It's not affordable to build new construction. And then we're going to see 2-3 years down the road, a same little issue that we had before, not enough homes. And what does that do? That raises prices. We have to be able to get more homes in order to have affordability, and they got to get ahead of it. And they can't be lead lag measures, and they can't look at the lag, because it's once they make the decision, it's too late. They break the economy one way or the other.
So we're watching jobs drop down dramatically. I mean, most of the numbers shoveled out by the Biden administration were bigger numbers, and then a month or two later, they'd correct them and say, oh, by the way, remember when we told you there were a lot of new jobs, 3 months ago? Well, it was actually a lot slower, a lot lower than what we said. And then last week, we got those numbers from last month saying, yeah, 114,000 new jobs, most of them in government or healthcare. So if you didn't happen to be a government or a healthcare worker, you got nothing. And I don't know what that means for next month, but it doesn't sound like we're going the right direction. What do you think the Federal Reserve's going to do in terms of a cut? And if they do make a cut, is it going to make any difference to the average person out there?
Yeah, so the betting on the Fed dot plop is like 75% of all the economists that they reviewed think they're going to be 2-3 cuts. So September, October, and November, they do believe that. Now, remember.
Now, that has nothing to do with the election, Nick. is that unconnected to the election?
Kind of like when you go on Facebook now, Lars, and state a truth. They come back with that infamous fact checker saying that it's a false claim and they block you. It's very interesting how those things work. But 2-3 rate cuts in the next 3 months. I see that a couple rate cuts. Now, remember, the market traditionally gets ahead of that and that already prices it in the market. But I don't think there's going to be any substantial rate cuts that are going to change the direction of the seasonal slowdown a little bit in the market. So I think things are going to kind of stay the same where they're at, maybe get a little bit better, but pretty much kind of a cool, homes are still selling, still not a lot of homes on the market. One thing that we are seeing that's a little bit different than the nationwide numbers is we have a lot less homes hitting the market than nationwide. Florida and Texas have a ton of properties hitting the market, but here in the Portland metro, Oregon, Southwest Washington, our inventory levels, yes, they're going up, but it's because homes are setting on the market longer, not new homes hitting the market.
See, and I think a lot of that has to do with Texas and Florida have actually loosened up the regs and said, hey, we want you to build. We're going to make it easier for you. And a lot of the blue states in America have said, no, we're not going to make it easier to build. Try to build against the headwinds of government and interest rates and the general economy. And that's doing well for states like Texas, where you say, well, if they build more houses, the prices should go down. And they have. And when the rest of the country is saying, no, you got to do it by the rules. If you don't do it by our rules, then you can't do it at all. That is Nick Shivers, one of the great supporters of this program, and we disclose that as well. His real estate business is the Nick Shivers team. And I'm curious where we end up going. We have a critical shortage of housing in most of America. We have government that stands in the way of that, usually with stupid rules that make no sense at all. And then we've got interest rates, which are driven also by the competitive borrowing of the federal government, which is borrowing to lead us into bankruptcy nationally one of these days. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Adjust your volume. He's just that loud. Lars Larson.
You know, we have to stay woke. Like, everybody needs to be woke. and
and you can talk about if you're the wokest or woker, but just stay more woke than less woke.
More woke than less woke. You know, she is a strange character, and I swear we're going to have to listen to several more months of Kamala Harris saying we got to be woke. Because nobody knows that she's one of the most extreme left-wing candidates on the planet. She's certainly the most extreme candidate on the American ballot this year. And yet, there she is saying to a friendly audience of interviewers, we've got to stay woke. We got to show everybody that everybody has to be woke, whatever woke means. Now, I've got my own definitions, and maybe you do as well. But this is how crazy she is. I mean, this is a woman saying we've got to stay woke, so you got to keep talking about it. Do you know she has now picked a vice presidential running mate in the governor of Minnesota, Mr. Walz, Governor Walz. And yet, in fact, she's even planning her first big campaign rally will not be in Minnesota. It will be in Pennsylvania, where she passed over the governor of Pennsylvania. That's fine. I mean, he's another liberal and a lying politician, because I never thought much of Shapiro, because Shapiro had actually won his office by promising school vouchers for parents. And then once he got into office, he found it kind of inconvenient to continue supporting vouchers. So he's the worst of the worst. He's not just somebody who opposes school vouchers and school choice. He's a guy who'd actually promise it to the voters, get their votes, become the governor, and then turn around and say, by the way, that thing I promised, I explicitly promised to do for you, I'm not going to be doing it for you. But Kamala Harris chooses Tim Walz, and she hasn't answered questions from anyone in days. I swear we're going to go through a replay of the 2020 election, where Joe Biden famously ensconced himself in his basement. He didn't hold big public rallies like Donald Trump. He didn't talk to a lot of reporters like Donald Trump. He didn't really answer questions at all, as Donald Trump has done happily. Donald Trump will answer even the questions that you didn't want him to answer. And in fact, the National Association of Black Journalists, a bigoted group, did just that the other day. They got answers they didn't want to hear. But here's Kamala Harris with her weird cackle saying, we've got to stay woke. Now, is she saying anything about how to address the most serious problems that America has right now? A government that is spending us into oblivion. Massive amounts of new national debt that threaten to actually, well, deconstruct the U.S. government. I mean, we've literally got to the point where the amount of debt that the United States government holds, we are now past $35 trillion in treasury debt. We have about $100 trillion in obligations that are not debt, but they're things like we got to pay all these Social Security checks and we don't have the money. Does she address any of that? No. She doesn't. And why? Because she doesn't have answers. I swear this woman doesn't even understand the issues. I mean, remember when she was asked about the war in Ukraine? And she started out by saying, well, Ukraine is a country in Europe, and it's very small. And Russia is another country, not in Western Europe, but Russia is another country, and they're having a war. It's like she's talking to a class of third graders. Just be prepared for it, folks, because that is what we're going to be listening to all the way to November the 5th. Except I don't think it's going to be over with the election. And let me tell you why. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you happen to be a naysayer, yeah, disagreeing with me or my guests or anything else about the show, we're glad to put you first in line. You just have to muster up the courage, have the cojones to actually come on and say, what is it you disagree about? And I'll be glad to let you have your say, as long as you let me ask a few questions in aid of an objection, as the lawyers like to say. But let me tell you why this is going to go well beyond November the 5th. And why? Number one, we're going to have a more messed up election, I figure, than we did even in 2020. A lot of states have changed their election laws. They have said we had what the Democrats described as the single most perfect election in American history. And their first reaction to that was, yes, and we have to change the laws by which our elections are held because it was not a perfect election. We've found more about hundreds of thousands of people who are double, triple, and even quadruple registered in other states, people who are dead who voted. I know it's been a long time Democrat tradition to have dead people vote, but there you go. But this is what's coming at us. One of the most prominent Democrats in the House of Representatives is a character by the name of Jamie Raskin, member of Congress and member of the Democrat Party. Now, if you want a taste of where things are going, number one, as you listen to what he says, this is really critical. Understand the Democrats are already anticipating that Kamala Harris and Tim Walz will lose, that Donald Trump will win, and that that will require them to do what they accused the Republicans of doing on January the 6th of 2021. Now, I understand.
It's necessary.
I'm going to have to back it. Take a listen. Take a listen to what Jamie Raskin has to say.
It's necessary, but it's not sufficient, because what can be put into the Constitution can slip away from you very quickly. And the greatest example going on right now before our very eyes is Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, which they're just disappearing with a magic wand, as if it doesn't exist, even though it could not be clearer what it's stating. And so, you know, they want to kick it to Congress. So it's going to be up to us on January 6, 2025 to tell the rampaging Trump mobs that he's disqualified. And then we need bodyguards for everybody and civil war conditions, all because the nine justices, not all of them, but these justices who have not many cases to look at every year, not that much work to do, a huge staff, great protection, simply do not want to do their job and interpret what the great 14th Amendment means.
Now, do you know what he's talking about? Section 3 of the 14th Amendment was written because after the Civil War, there was general agreement that anybody who had taken part in the Civil War on the South side of that dispute, should not be allowed to run for office. And Jamie Raskin is saying, well, the 14th Amendment says those people who are involved in an armed insurrection against the United States government, and that's what the Civil War was, and nobody disputes that, we shouldn't let them run for office. Now, could they bring that case right now? Say, well, we've got Donald Trump. He's guilty of insurrection. Really? Everybody who tells me that, I say to them, well, if he's guilty of insurrection and there's evidence of that, why hasn't the Biden DOJ actually charged him with insurrection? Why haven't they charged somebody else with insurrection? And the answer is they haven't, because the evidence isn't there. And yet Jamie Raskin is saying on the, and he's explicit about it. Just, I'm not having to read anything into this. He says on January 6, 2025, we're going to have to remind people of what Section 3 says. It says, if you're involved in an armed insurrection against the United States government, something that nobody has been charged with as a result of January 6, 2021, certainly not Donald Trump, then you are disqualified to run for office. They're already anticipating Harris and Walz lose. They're already anticipating that Donald Trump and J.D. Vance win, and that on January 6th, the Democrats, the ultimate election deniers, will show up and say Donald Trump can't be president because of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And we've got Jamie Raskin on videotape saying exactly that. Glad to be with you on a Tuesday. Always glad to take your calls at 866-439-5277.
The Lars Larson Show. When he talks, you have no choice but to listen. More with Lars.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls in a moment. I want to talk about Google for a moment. I don't have any great love of Google. It is a search engine that I use, but I don't particularly like the company. I don't like the way that it seems to involve itself in twisting and turning when it comes to supplying people with the information that they request. If they were just a benign, agnostic kind of search engine, no problem. But they don't do business that way, so I don't particularly like them. However, I'm not sure I agree with the conclusion reached in a very significant legal ruling that says that Google is a monopoly. So I got to check with somebody who knows better than I do, and that's Jessica Malusian with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Jessica, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the headline issue, and that is, a yes or no, is Google a monopoly, and if so, why?
Well, so in this recent case, it actually started during the Trump administration. That's how long it's been going on. The court found that in a couple areas, it's not a monopolist, but in a couple, it is, and it's acting illegally. So the one that I think is the biggest deal is that Google has contracts with phone makers, Apple, Android, and some phone carriers, for their search to be default loaded on those phones. If you, as a buyer of those phones, don't like Google search and you would prefer DuckDuckGo or Bing or whatever else makes you happy, it takes under a minute to switch over to a different default. But nevertheless, the court said that those big agreements are anti-competitive and are a problem in that they violate antitrust law.
Now, this is going to get appealed, so we don't know where that's going to go. But let me ask you something, Jessica. I know this is going to go before your time and show how very old I am. But this sounds like Janet Reno's lawsuit against Microsoft way back in the day, because Microsoft had this amazingly popular search engine called Internet Explorer, which they insisted on putting on a bunch of computers in a deal they did, I think, with Dell. And it was forcing people to use it. Now, Jessica, I don't know about you, but I don't know of anybody who uses Internet Explorer today. So apparently their dominance did not exactly dominate. But that was the case from Reno. Is this the same kind of idea, that you've put this search engine on people's computers, which they can immediately load some other search engine, not a problem, easy to do, and yet somehow that makes them a monopoly?
Well, you hit the nail on the head, and I owe you a drink or $10 for saying that I'm too young to know about Microsoft. I wish that was the case, but I do remember that trial, and you're exactly right. It's a similar issue. And another similarity I will point out is by the time we got to the end of that Microsoft trial, well, everything went mobile, right? And it was all working in a different way. We weren't just, you know, the whole idea of a computer wasn't just a desktop computer anymore.
Nope, we went. Look, we lost her for a second. I'll tell you what, Joel, can you get Jessica back? Because I want to hear the rest of this explanation. But this is a mess. I mean, it's a mess because we've got a court saying that Google is a monopoly. As I said, I've got no great love of Google. I, in fact, don't like the politics of the company. But I don't think they're a monopoly, nor do I think that if I buy a new device and they say, well, the default search engine is this, I just go back and change it. But in that case, did that case just get mooted out and they said it doesn't matter anymore because everybody's gone mobile at this point, Jessica?
Exactly right. The pace of the market just beat out the regulators. And I think you're going to see something similar maybe happen here. As you said, Google will surely appeal this decision. This will be in the courts for years before we even start talking about what the remedies might be. And by then, perhaps all of the new artificial intelligence will have made search something we don't even understand right now, right? The whole landscape could change in the tech world in a couple of years. That's another, I think, important similarity between the Microsoft case and this one.
Okay, so do I understand this correctly then? All Google has to do as a company is say, okay, our lawyers are going to make a lot of money for them over the next few years. We're going to work this one through the court system. And in a number of years, it's likely to just fade away the same way the Microsoft case did. And instead of having to pay giant fines or penalties or anything else, they'll just have to pay the cost of their lawyers for a bunch of years to keep this thing going through all the appeals. And at the end, it'll probably just fade away. And it'll be one more example, like Reno was, of a major government agency using the taxpayers' resources to harass a private company, again, one I don't have any love for, but a private company, and cause them to spend a bunch of money but not actually accomplish anything for the average citizen. Am I wrong in looking at it that way?
No, I think that that's a real possibility. And furthermore, even if we did get to the point where they said, okay, you can't have these contracts, because in these contracts where they pay these phone manufacturers for that default space, a lot of times those phone manufacturers, your phone costs less when you buy it because they're using that revenue stream. So
right.
If you stopped Google from doing that, maybe your phone costs more. So I think even worse than it doesn't matter and we've wasted time and money might be it ends up hurting consumers.
Well, and in fact, right now, based on the court deciding Google's a monopoly, that was the headline, does the ruling actually take effect and say you must end these contracts now, or do the contracts continue on until at some point there is a final resolution of this whole thing?
As of right now, the contracts carry on because we haven't got to what's called the remedy part of the case. So that's, you know, that's just a guess that I'm making that.
Yep, we lost our connection again. I'm sorry about that, Jessica, but this is a terrible situation because here's the thing, folks. She's right. If they're paying money to the phone companies, the cell phone companies, the smartphone companies, for the most part, if they're paying money to those companies, and those companies then inevitably pass along the savings to the customers. And I know that some of you will say, no, but those companies will not pass along the savings. Actually, that's not the practical experience, is it, Jessica? If the cell phone companies and the other mobile device makers are getting that extra money, it effectively reduces the cost because there's competition. It reduces the cost which they sell those devices to consumers. I know people are going to fear, oh, no, the greedy companies will just hang on to the money. Yeah, except they're all in competition with each other, and they realize when you're selling cell phones to average folks who can only afford so much, the one who can sell the cheapest cell phone or one that's at no more expensive than the competition is going to sell more than if you say, let's just hang on to all this cash and charge a lot more for our phones. There's a reason they don't do that.
Yeah, they have every incentive to give you a little better price so that you pick them. And, you know, and also just on the merits of Google, you don't have to love the politics of Google to know that it makes a pretty darn good search engine. You know, it has a high market share for a reason. People have different preferences. They're welcome to choose something else. But the vast majority of people do choose Google for search.
So where does it go from here? And what other moves will they make? Because I'm hoping that with a new administration come January, we're going to get a whole new DOJ. But as you said, some of these cases get rolling under one presidency and they continue on into another. Is that what we're likely to see, even if we get, as I hope, a Donald Trump administration in January? Does the steam engine of the DOJ just keep on paving over or rolling over things?
Yeah, I mean, listen, if the DOJ lost on appeal, which Google will surely appeal this, a new Trump DOJ might choose not to pursue that. They might just leave it there. So you could hope for an ending there, which would be, you know, a nice way to stop sort of wasting taxpayer money on problems that really aren't problems for consumers, right? I mean, Google search is free. Phones cost less because of these arrangements. Where's the real problem here? Might be a problem for competitors, but you know, the one who stands to gain the most all of this, by the way, is Microsoft, which is worth $1 trillion more than Alphabet, Google's owner. So to spend all this money protecting the world's biggest company from the third biggest company is really ridiculous.
It really is. Jessica, thank you very much. That's Jessica Malusian. Jessica, we always appreciate your insights. Make this stuff understandable. She's with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. I'll get to your phone calls and emails in just a moment. At 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LarsLarsen.com. Coming up next on the Radio Northwest Network, Ghost Guns. You've heard me.
The Zoom meeting you actually want to be at. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday live on the Radio Northwest Network, which serves the Pacific Northwest states, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. Now, I want to talk about ghost guns. And I think that term of art, ghost gun, is entirely deceptive. I know that most of the media likes to use the term, but let me dig into that in a moment. First, if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarsen.com. And if you want to vote in our poll on X, and yeah, we've got a poll on what used to be Twitter, the daily question we try to make as fresh and as pungent as we can: should more states follow Louisiana's lead and castrate child predators? I'd answer that one yes, and here's the background. Last week, on Thursday, Louisiana became the first state in the country to to say that child rapists can now be ordered by a judge to be castrated, that is, their testicles removed, and not because of gender confusion, if the victim of their crime, when they are convicted of raping a child, is under the age of 13, and if the offender is older than 17. So you don't have a Romeo and Juliet problem. The law already allows judges to issue an order of chemical castration. Now they can order a physical castration. If that wouldn't be intimidating, I don't know who wouldn't be intimidated by that. The law includes the crime of pornography involving children as an underlying offense, so it's not just limited to male offenders. It can be females as well. At the end of the day, I hope that kids know that they can feel safer because they have some really tough penalties that occur when somebody violates their innocence. That is from the author of the bill, Senator Regina Barrow, who's from Baton Rouge. So the question, should more states follow Louisiana's lead and castrate child predators? I say yes. I say just putting it on the books is likely to intimidate a number of people out of even contemplating that kind of awful act against a child. Today's X-Poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, what has happened? I do not own any ghost guns. I do not at this time seek to get any ghost guns. But a ghost gun is, in modern parlance, what they're talking about. Is somebody, and they usually try to scare people half to death by saying, why, do you know you can buy plans on how you can make your own gun? You might be able to even print it out and have a printed gun, and you would make your own gun. And when people hear that, they imagine all kinds of criminals who are coming up with firearms that they obtain by manufacturing them. Let me tell you, I think my impression is that the vast majority of criminals out there are too lazy to deal with guns they have to make. When a criminal wants a gun, they go out and they buy it illegally. That's how most of the guns used by criminals to commit armed robberies or kidnappings or murders, that sort of thing. They go out and they buy a gun. They buy a gun that in most cases has been stolen from somebody, which means the gun is already illegally in the possession of one person, and then they illegally sell it to somebody else. So you have lots of laws on the books already to go after the criminals who do this. But the state of Oregon has adopted a brand new ban on the possession and sale of ghost guns. And now the Oregon Firearms Federation, that's Kevin Starrett and his group, who you hear on the show from time to time, because the anti-gunners will not come on the show and even talk about these things, they have brought a lawsuit challenging this new rule that bans ghost guns or guns made by an individual American citizen. Because that's the way you have to think about it. If you went back to when the First and Second Amendment was first put in the U.S. Constitution as a protection of our God-given rights, the government wasn't granting you the right to own a gun. You have that right because you are a citizen of the United States. It is a God-given right. What does the Constitution say? It says the government can't come in and take that right away because it is protected. Your right to keep and bear arms is protected by the Constitution. And you say, well, what about a gun you make yourself? Well, if you went back to the founders and you said, well, what was going on when they wrote this rule? An awful lot of guns were being manufactured by individual Americans, not to commit crimes, because they needed a gun and it was expensive to buy a gun. Now, their objection is, ghost guns are untraceable, with their parts typically bought online and then assembled at home. They also lack commercial serial numbers. Well, if they don't qualify under the National Firearms Act, then you can't require a serial number on a gun that doesn't have a serial number. Now, is this going to make a major impact or hold criminals back from committing crimes? Well, the very political Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum of Oregon, who, thank goodness, is leaving office next year. She says the guns assembled from online kits or made from 3D printers are weapons of choice for gun traffickers or people who can't otherwise legally obtain a gun. I think that is provably untrue. The vast majority of guns that are confiscated from criminals or used in crimes are not manufactured or 3D printed. They are simply stolen from legitimate owners, sold to criminals. But now OFF, the Oregon Firearms Federation, has filed a lawsuit in federal court. They did it yesterday. It's backed up by two gun rights advocacy groups and three members of their group. They say that the ban prohibits them from exercising their Second Amendment rights to keep and bear arms. And I think they're right. And I think they're going to win this case. And I don't think the ghost gun ban is doing a darn thing about the violence and the crime which the people in charge, including Rosenblum, have allowed to happen. It's the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson.
For the big show.
In exactly 15
seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
With great humility, I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
My memory is so bad, I let you speak.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Tuesday. It's my pleasure to be with you, and it looks like Kamala Harris and her new running mate, Tim Walz, and yeah, he's got warts all over him. He is the governor of Minnesota, but as far as I can tell, he's got so many negatives. It's going to be fun to watch them run because I don't think they're going to go anywhere. But welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. If you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, you'll go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. I want to bring on Elizabeth New, who is a research analyst and director of the Center for Worker Rights and Healthcare at Washington Policy. Elizabeth, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Lars.
You and I have been talking about so many different state programs that are launched. I don't even know that I could assume that they're launched with good intentions. But things like this paid leave program that was launched about 5 years ago, how is that working right now for citizens, or is it working for citizens right now?
Lars, this is a bad program. Paid family medical leave in Washington state has workers giving a portion of their wages to other workers who sometimes have more income than they do and no need for taxpayer help. You know, the Employment Security Department and the governor were bragging about how many people have been helped with taxpayer dollars through the program, but left unsaid was how many people, including those with low wages, have less money to handle their own life needs because of the program.
Because people have to understand that the amount of benefits you get for this paid leave is small enough that for the average worker, maybe above minimum wage, but not a very well-paid worker, they're not going to have enough money to take time off. But for the well-compensated worker who's already planning to take time off, a husband or a wife with a baby, for example, they'll say, oh, well, my wife's going to take some weeks or months off, or my husband's going to take some time off, and we can afford to do it. We'll get a, you know, we'll get a fraction of what we regularly make, but it won't matter to us because we're upper income. Is that the way it sort of adds up?
Yeah, you know, the program is considered progressive, which I think that word has been hijacked. But the program is considered progressive because it replaces more of a low-income person's wages than it does a higher-income person's wages. But even though this program gives more by percentage of wages to applicants who are low income, some low income people don't even apply for the program because, one, they don't need it, or two, because 10% less of their wages is not doable for them. And still, their wages have been decreased by the state for other workers who can get by with less money.
So it's kind of a program that does a reverse Robin Hood. It robs from the poor to benefit the rich. I mean, is that too blunt a way of describing it?
No, I think that's exactly what we're doing with this and WalCares. And payroll tax has become the new vehicle for favored issues of lawmakers. You know, they keep creating these social programs, and they're safety nets for people who are in financial need of taxpayer help and people who are not. It's suicide.
Okay, there are two issues I want to ask you about that. Number one, I thought an income tax was effectively unconstitutional in the state of Washington because it said you can have an income tax, but it's limited to, I think it's 1%, and it must be uniform. That is, if Jeff Bezos still lived in Seattle, he would pay the same percentage as the lowest minimum wage worker, and that's the only way you can have it, and it's limited to 1%. Isn't a payroll tax an income tax, especially if different people at different wages pay different amounts? Because that's a classic income tax.
Right now, I believe they're playing by the rules, but let's not kid ourselves. Payroll taxes feel like income taxes. These are less than 1% of a person. The tax rate is less than 1%, so it fits that. And it takes a percentage of one's wages in the same way. So I think it's permissible. That doesn't mean it doesn't feel like an income tax.
Okay, but somebody making, and you said the average wage is kind of stunning. The average income in Washington State is $84,000 a year. That right. person is going to pay more than $600 into paid family and medical leave, but it's not likely to necessarily produce the kind of, you know, family leave payment that would let people take time off. That's the gist of it, right?
Yeah.
No, I'll tell you what, we got to fix that drop. Joel, can you get her back on the line if you don't mind? I don't know why that dropped off. We've had a little bit of a technical problem, so just understand it that way. But Employment Security says the state's average income, $84,000. In 2024, a worker making that wage would have paid $444 for benefits they might not ever need or might not ever use. And the person's employer would pay almost $200 on that employee's behalf, again, for benefits that the employee might not ever even use or need. That $622 going into paid family and medical leave for the average worker in a year, with a very small number of people who will actually avail themselves of that. Is the program right now, Elizabeth, now that we've reconnected with you, is it actually paying for itself? Or should I anticipate that Olympia is going to look at this and say, yep, it turns out we're not collecting enough taxes, and they're going to have to increase the amount that they charge to workers to make this thing pencil out?
This does not pencil out. In fact, they've already bailed out paid family and medical leave once when they saw it was going to start running in the red in a matter of time. And by artificially inflating the amount in that program, they lowered the tax rate just slightly. But now they're saying the tax rate will have to go higher again. There could be budget trouble as early as October, I heard in a recent meeting. So it's not paying its way. And, you know, lawmakers are concerned. In the last meeting I was in where they were talking about this, they said they were thinking about, one, raising the rate or finding different parameters for it.
And they're going to raise the rate, but they can't raise it past 1% and keep it constitutional. Will the amount of money they could raise it by be enough to make it financially solvent?
You know, that's a great question, and we'll see. You know, they talk much about how popular the program is. And, you know, one of the lawmakers who is really for this is concerned and definitely says, I wonder if we have structured this properly to make sure we don't have a funding crisis every other year.
Okay, and what are the administrative, while we've got time, what are the administrative costs? Because on WaCares, they're saying for every $10 they collect, it costs $2.50 to collect the money. Are the administrative costs also high on this one?
They're high. I don't even know if that WaCares number is exactly correct. They're holding the money aside, but I wouldn't put my name on the line to say that they're spending 25%.
Wow. Okay, Elizabeth New, who's at the Washington Policy Center. Elizabeth, thanks very much. Coming up in a moment, is sending a ballot to every single registered voter a dangerous thing when it comes to representative government? We'll get to that next on the Lars Larson Show. August is now.
Broadcasting from his socially distanced bunker to yours, it's sanitized entertainment. Here's Lars Larson.
I understand why the idea sounds good on paper. You register every single eligible person in America to vote, and then you send a ballot to every single one. And in states that now have largely or entirely vote-by-mail systems, you say, what could possibly go wrong? And most of us who've watched vote-by-mail and the train wreck that vote-by-mail is for American voters, we understand there's a lot that can go wrong. And I found a great local, a great example of this happening in Nevada. I'll get to the details of that in just a moment. First, if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's always here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. If you happen to be a naysayer, we love naysayers. If somebody disagrees with my point of view, that's the best way to fact check and actually challenge me. And if I can't come up with good answers, then people can draw their own conclusions. But naysayers always welcome at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And our poll on X today, should more states follow Louisiana's lead and castrate child predators? As of last week, the state of Louisiana has become the first in the country to say that child rapists can now be ordered by a judge to be castrated if the victim is under the age of 13 and the offender is older than the age of 17. So we're not talking about boyfriend-girlfriend situations. We're talking about the rape of children by adults. And in that case, yes, you can do castration in Louisiana. As far as I'm concerned, every state in America would be ahead of the game if they simply said, we're not going to let this happen. And if you do it, you might just lose a few things downstairs. So you can find the poll online at Lars Larson Show on X. You can also find it on our website at LarsLarson.com. Now, I would be not telling you the truth if I didn't disclose I don't like vote by mail. And I've lived in vote by mail states, two of them, for about the last 20 years. And they have a tremendously detrimental effect on voting and on elections and, frankly, on people's faith in elections. And I'm going to cite Jimmy Carter, the former president of the United States, not the best president. He was one of the worst presidents in American history. But he sat on a presidential commission in which they were charged with looking at America's voting system. And this was about 15 years ago. And what did they conclude? They concluded that vote by mail, and in whatever form it takes, whether it's just massive use of absentee ballots, as we saw during the pandemic, or states that have gone entirely to vote by mail offers the greatest opportunities for fraud in elections. And that was the conclusion of a presidential commission headed up by Jimmy Carter. So what's happening today? I saw this great piece in The Federalist, and it was written, I need to give credit where credit is due. I think it's Sean Carney. It's Sean Fleetwood. Sean Fleetwood is the author, and he deserves credit for this. But what he talked about, he says, Nevada's system of automatically mailing a ballot to everybody on the voter rolls makes the state's failure to keep clean voter rolls even more dire. And that was the conclusion of a watchdog group that last week said they found more than 100 people on Nevada's voter rolls who had voted in another state. Now, last week, I told you about a brand new study by another group that found 300,000 people nationwide who are registered to vote in more than one state. A number of them were voted registered to vote in more than two states, so there are three or more. And a number of people were actually registered to vote in four states or more. And here's what Chuck Muth says. He's president and CEO of the Citizen Outreach Foundation. The biggest problem is they changed the law in 2021 so that every active voter is automatically mailed a ballot. So we need the cleanest possible voter files to protect against potential fraud. At this point, I'll jump away from what Sean Fleetwood is writing about, and I'll remind you. About half the states in America have signed up with something called ERIC, the Electronic Records Information Center. And what ERIC is supposed to do is help states keep their voter rolls clean. That is, it takes off the names of voters who've died It takes off the names of voters who've moved. It takes off the names of voters who appear to be voting in a different state, and it simply takes them off the rolls. Except that what Eric actually does, because it is funded by left-wing organizations, it identifies with so-called progressives or liberals, they make it almost impossible to clean up the voter rolls. You would think that all that would happen is somebody would move, they'd notify the elections headquarters in the new state, I have registered to vote in the new state, take me off the rolls in the old state. Now, you'd think that'd be very, very easy, especially when voters have re-registered somewhere else, then they are not qualified to vote again at their previous address. I can't tell you, especially at election times, how often I get emails from people. One gentleman last week even sent me a picture. He said, my wife and I each received two mail ballots. Should we vote both of them? In other words, a couple living by themselves, nobody else in the house, and they get four ballots in the mail. Now, that is a system that is thoroughly screwed up. And I know that after mentioning it, I'll get more and more people saying, well, that happened to me, too. People who get multiple ballots, people who get ballots for a child who's moved out of the house, for a loved one in the family who's already died years ago, and yet they're still carried on the voter rolls because the voter rolls are not being cleaned up. Based in Nevada, the Citizen Outreach Foundation wanted to ensure the accuracy of the state's voter rolls through what they called the Pigpen Project. That initiative assists local elections officials, this is from the Federalist, by identifying individuals who are no longer eligible to remain on the voter registration lists. So last week, the team at this organization said, we're going to take a look at what's on the rolls right now. They have filed legal challenges contesting the eligibility of almost 4,000 people that should no longer be on Nevada's voter rolls because they don't live in the state of Nevada anymore. In fact, most of those, no big surprise, were filed in Clark County, which is the big county around one of the big counties at Las Vegas. And what have they found? They found that some of these people were identified elsewhere and that was not what the system was supposed to do. So we know there are problems. We know they're sending out ballots. We know they're sending out ballots who shouldn't be to people who shouldn't be registered to vote anymore, and they're doing it anyway. Let me go to Stephen. Hey, Stephen, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Lars, pleasure to talk to you today. I have come across a thesis from a student, I think it's American University, and the student was out of Albuquerque. It's somebody who I won't mention on air. I'm happy to email it to you. But the entire thesis was kind of under the guise of why is there more sophistication and privacy to log into my cell phone with biometrics than there is to vote? And the argument is that we should just move to an entirely biometric voting system. It would be easy, it would be simple, and it would solve every problem. But, you know, for obvious reasons.
Like the idea of, say, using the biometric confirmation on your cell phone to be able to vote? Because I think the problem...
Oh, no. My point is that I think there are many sophisticated procedures that could be put into place that would allow, without tracking, you know, DNA, et cetera, that would allow us to have secured voting.
I think the best way to do it is start by eliminating everybody who's double registered to vote across America.
The Lars Larson Show. You can't get enough, Lars. Podcast every show at LarsLarson.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And frankly, I don't understand Kamala Harris. I don't understand the way that she was chosen. I don't understand what she's trying to do in her own party. But frankly, if it works in the long run to get Donald Trump back in the White House in January, I'll still be okay with it. The Democrats can do whatever crazy thing they want to right now. But I want to talk to our friend John Tillman, who's CEO of the American Culture Project, about what Kamala Harris is doing to divide her own party. John, welcome back.
Great to be back with you, Lars. Always enjoy being on your show.
Thank you, sir. Well, we had Joe Biden, who promised to unify America and then immediately launched in a whole bunch of frankly, disgusting behavior on his part, you know, in suggesting that MAGA Americans were some kind of Nazis or white supremacists or whatever. So he didn't exactly do that. Now we've got Kamala Harris. She hasn't been talking a lot. She's having a rally with a number of people in Pennsylvania right now, including the guy who lost out on the vice presidential sweepstakes, perhaps because of his faith. But we can get into that ugly topic later on. But is Kamala Harris dividing her own party with this little process of choosing a VP?
Well, any Democrat nominee, and Kamala is going to do it the most of anyone, is the basic premise of that piece I had in the New York Post yesterday, is they can't win unless they get supermajority shares and high turnout of blacks, Hispanics, single women, younger voters 18 to 29, and now they're trying to get the Asians and the LGBT community all to become their group identity political core of their base. The challenge with that is they've also started to fold in Muslim Americans and Muslim American immigrants, and that is in conflict with their long traditional support from Jewish American voters. And this is one of the things that they want to keep doing, is have all these people stay in their silos. We've given you your group identity. We want to create grievance and have you become angry and then turn out in large numbers. That is the recipe, because, as you know, Lars, they are having trouble gaining white voters. Two-thirds of the electorate is still white, and 60% of those, on average, will go for Donald Trump, and that is their great dilemma and why they're trying to do this division politics instead of unity politics.
Well, and shouldn't everybody, of whatever political stripe you are, reject the idea of identity politics? I don't vote as a white American male, even though I am a white American male, any more than I choose employees because they're white or because they're male or because they're American. I do like hiring Americans, but I'll reserve that one as the one I think I'm entitled to do. But shouldn't everybody just naturally say, you're not going to get me just because of my skin color, my gender, or sexual preference? You should get me based on what you're capable of doing if you want to be a leader in the United States. I would think that people would naturally reject that whole idea, and especially the people of color, to say, oh, you want us to vote as a black bloc or a Hispanic bloc? Isn't the very notion that all blacks vote one way or all Hispanics vote one way because of their skin color, isn't that bigoted just to begin with?
I couldn't agree more. And in fact, I think one of the things that's so off-putting about group identity politics as an electoral strategy, which is what we're talking about here, this is the Democrat Party's electoral strategies, divide us by the group identity that they've been assigned, and say to you, we're going to dehumanize you. We're going to reduce the essence of who you are as an individual and say that everything in your life is determined by the group identity we've assigned you. What is happening, though, and I actually think that one day we'll look back on this era as one of the transformational times in the realignment of politics. What conservatives should be doing, and to some degree what Trump is doing, is saying, what's more important to you? That identity somebody has assigned to you, or your life situation, your ability to pay your mortgage, your ability to make the groceries balance out every week with 30% higher prices, the fact that can't fill your gas tank up anymore. Your life situation is the identity that really matters to you. And when you think about it, we all get along in our everyday life. We all walk around in our workplaces and public spaces and out at restaurants and bars, entertainment facilities, black, white, and brown, new immigrants, people from the Mayflower, everybody in between. Lars, we all get along. The only place this division is happening is in the political arena and in the media arena, because that's the only way Democrats can win elections, by creating this grievance, ginning up issues like the border, abortion rights, bailout of student debt, on and on with all these policies that try to create the grievance and get those high turnouts I talked about.
Well, see, it's irritated me for decades, John, that even the U.S. Census, which should count Americans, instead counts Americans and then says, now divide yourself up into 65 different racial classifications and marital or coupling situations and give us all this data. I would think that most Americans would look at that and say, you can count the number of people in my house, which, frankly, I didn't eat the last census taker who walked up my driveway a couple of years ago with some fava beans. But I did tell him, you get to count the people in my family. I'm not giving you anything else. You're not entitled to anything else. And I would hope, and I said it politely, but I did send him on his way. I would hope that most Americans would react that way. Don't start trying to pigeonhole me. Why do you think, because you're a reporter, you write columns as well, but I'm just wondering why you think Americans are tolerating this kind of treatment by people who want to pigeonhole them?
Well, this is a big topic, but essentially what's happening is the left's strategy is to turn everybody into a victim, and only the government can come in and right the thing that's been wrong. So if you've not had, everybody in their life has a calamity. All of us have something that goes wrong at one time or another. We didn't get the girlfriend or the boyfriend we wanted. We didn't get the job we wanted. Our raise wasn't big enough. We have disappointments in life. This is part of the human experience. What the Democrat Party's philosophy is when you have that sort of calamity, it's not your fault. You're a victim. And the oppressor is white men and the white supremacy and systemic racism. And only we, the government, can come in and properly put our foot on the scale to create justice and fairness for you. We all have two dimensions to ourselves. Part of us, when something bad happens to us, we like it when someone puts their arm around us and says, you know, that's not fair for you. You're going to be okay. And most of us get back up and go back at it and get back in the game with a pat on the butt. But what they want us to do is they want us to enjoy our victimization and the whole idea of the government coming in and solving it. And for some people in our world, that is appealing. That's who they're appealing to. They're appealing to our lesser selves. The other side of that coin is that we have hope and aspiration. We want a better tomorrow than we have today, but that requires us to take agency over our lives. The group identity politics takes away agency over your life and dehumanizes you. What the right is selling is that you have agency and control over your life, and it's not as easy, but it's much more fulfilling. It's a little bit of a harder argument, but it's one that I think is going to win in the end.
And, John, the thing I find amazing is most people like to sit around and say, I know how to do this. I know how to frame a house. I know how to pour concrete. I know how to cook a great meal. I have all these skills and capabilities. And I'm just trying to imagine a bunch of people who subscribe to that nonsense, who sit around and say, well, this awful thing happened and that awful thing happened. And like you said, everybody in a room, there may be a rare exception, is going to be capable of saying, well, what bad thing happened to you doesn't begin to compare to the bad thing that happened to me. I mean, sit around with a bunch of losers like that, where they're constantly talking about all the things that have gone wrong in their life, instead of saying, you know, like all the autobiographies I read when I was a little kid, I loved autobiographies. It was like, and this kid had this horrible childhood and grew up to be a famous, you know, war hero or famous athlete or something like that. When can we get back to the America where people say, these are all the rotten things that happened, and you know what? I got past all of it and became very good at this.
Well, that is such a great comment, Lars, because we used to cherish the ability to overcome difficulty. Now we revel in it and we wallow in it, and we're encouraged to do that by our very government and one of the major parties of our government, of our country. The Democrat Party wants you to wallow in things when they go awry and rely on the government to solve it for you, whereas we used to cherish and revere the very thing you said, which is self-reliance, ability to overcome. Not that it's easy, not that people don't suffer. There's no straight path to happiness and success in life. Sometimes some people have it easier than others for a variety of reasons, but in the end, you have to decide whether you want to live a life where you're in the canoe and you have a paddle and you can govern which way you go down the river, or do you want to be in the canoe with no paddle and just let the stream of government take you where you go and you have no control of your destination? That's
very well said. That is John Tillman, the CEO of the American Culture Project, and he was writing at the New York Post. John, thank you very much for the time. Your phone calls and emails are coming up next on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Summer is...
Email talk at LarsLarson.com. He actually reads them. More with Lars right now.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. This segment of the show brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialist, Oregon Medical Centers. And our X-Poll question today goes this way. Should more states follow Louisiana's lead and castrate child predators? The state of Louisiana made that the law as of Thursday of last week. If you have a victim under the age of 13, if the criminal is older than 17, the judge is allowed to order not just chemical castration, which is already on the books in Louisiana, but is also physical castration as well. I think it's at least a deterrent, or should be a deterrent for most people. Let's go to Chris in Richland. Hey, Chris, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. Thanks for listening on KONA.
Hey, Lars. Hey, a couple quick things here. The deal with the voting and cleaning up the registers and things like that, number one, I don't think the politicians are going to fix anything, because if we do fix it, they won't have a job. Number two, why can't the ability to vote, why can't it follow something like your driver's license registration? You move to another state, you have so many days to change your license, that will automatically trigger cancellation in your previous state.
I think that's a great idea. And I can tell you the one reason that will keep it from happening right now is that thing I mentioned to you, Eric, the Electronic Records Information Center. This is a private organization that states have given control. I mean, that's a crazy idea to begin with. Imagine a state saying, we have all these voter records, they are managed by government, and we're going to allow an outside party, which is liberal-funded private organization, we're going to allow them control over all those records. That's insane to begin with. But then when you say, well, doesn't Eric tell you, you know, that Chris from Richland has now moved to, you know, Medford, Oregon, and so you should take him off the rolls in Washington State and put him on the rolls in Oregon, except they don't do that. Because Eric takes the view that they want a lot of people registered, and they make it very difficult to take people off the rolls and very easy to put people on the rolls.
Yes, understand. It's not a good thing.
So that's the short answer, is they make it almost impossible to do it. Thanks for the call, Chris. Let's go to Sean. Hey, Sean, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network and KXL. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. First-time caller, long-time listener.
Thank you.
Two things. The first thing is castration. Yes, please. I wish they did that Oregon, Washington, and every
state. Put it on the ballot. I bet the voters would vote for it.
Oh, my gosh. I wish they did that. Would that be a deterrent? I hope so.
Well, it would for some. An awful lot of sexual criminals, according to the cops I've talked to over the years, are violent criminals, and they want to do something degrading to their victim. And they may or may not be, many of them may be impotent already, and so they're not doing it out of sexual motive. But having said that, if you said, you do this, this is going to happen to you, I think it would deter at least a certain percentage of sexual criminals. Okay,
yeah,
after that,
50% at least. You know.
I would think so. What else was on your mind?
So the other thing, I just moved to Battleground. I've owned a small business. Well, why? it's actually a nice town.
I didn't say why. I said, it's a good town.
It is a good town. I was born and raised in Beaverton and Tigard. And I finally moved out there and met a girl. We moved out there.
Congrats.
And all this stuff, I got a bunch of stuff from the state of Oregon, from the IRS, saying, you owe this from 2016 when I started my business for doing business in Multnomah County. And
you weren't penalties, were you in Multnomah County?
I was not. No, I was just doing business in Multnomah County. And most of my business I do is Washington County and Gamil County and stuff. I don't really do business in Multnomah County. But yeah, they sent me a tax. It's not the Metro tax. It's not the art tax. It's just and it says Ted Wheeler on top.
Is it their stupid arts tax?
It's not the arts tax. It's only like $35. They're coming after me for $3,000.
But is it income taxes?
No, it has nothing to do with that. It's just doing business in Multnomah County.
Except, and I guess it's up to you to prove you were not doing business in Multnomah County. I'm not a tax advisor, but I'd start by calling that bureaucracy and saying, I've never done business in Multnomah County. You're saying I did. I did not. Would you like the records to show that I didn't?
That's the problem, is I called them and I go, where did this come from? Because it didn't come until I moved out of state.
I understand that, but what are they using to establish that you did any business in that county?
They said it was, they just got it from the state IRS. It just came in, but it was from 8 years ago.
I understand it was 8 years ago, but Sean, what are they doing to say you did business in Multnomah County? They have to have something.
Nothing.
No address, no customer that was in the county, none of that?
When I started my business, I lived on Skyline in Multnomah County,
yep.
and I was out of there in 6 months, and that's where they based it from.
But did you move your business and indicate that you're no longer at that address?
I did, and as soon as I moved my CCB license from Oregon to Battleground, Washington, that's when I started getting letters.
Yeah, because they probably looked at you. I mean, they will chase people down for money like crazy. But if you can establish, I only did business with there 8 years ago, and I only did it for 6 months, and then I moved elsewhere outside of Multnomah County, unfortunately, it's probably going to be your burden to prove it. But it sounds like you can do that. And when you do, maybe they'll stop chasing you. They're pretty greedy when it comes to taxes. The Lars Larson.